Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's August 5th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
I'm Scott Long, and do you think we can call ourselves that if we don't win the Poker Podcast Awards?
Yes.
All right. I was just trying to put a little extra pressure on our fans there, so.
You know. Well, we're not using any documentation, by the way, when we say that. We're just saying we are.
I just, you know. Okay. So that's good to know. I just want to know because, you know, if we're got to stop saying that because we don't win, I'm going to cry.
No, we're going to win.
Anyone wants to see me cry.
The other thing, too, is we're going to talk about this later, about these awards, but I think they take the top five. So it's not like you're going to be, like, the winner of the best podcast.
Okay, so you're comfortable with us just being a bridesmaid.
Yeah, I mean, when I do the introduction after the awards are over and we win, we come in the top five, I'll say, you're listening to the top five poker podcast on the planet.
Excellent, excellent. All right. Well, are you? It's going to be great that we're the best poker podcast on the planet when you make it to the World Series Poker Heads Up Championship next year.
And I will have a big patch on, and no matter what they say, I am going to wear it. They're not going to stop me from wearing the patch.
A man can't keep you down.
Oh, but I'm glad you brought that up. You know, ESPN and the World Series, it's always going to be number one in my heart. Because they do things differently, and they're trying to always think outside the box. It may not always work, but sometimes it does. And this week, I'm glad the TV show's back on, because it gives me a reason to start paying attention to the poker world again, other than my own little pod here at the house. And they had the Heads Up Championship. They had the last two matches, the semifinals, and then they had the finals the following hour. And there was something really cool there, and I wanted to get your take on it. You know, I think a couple of years ago they brought up that triple chance event where you had three equal stacks and whatever. And this was set up like that. They had add-on chips, and you know, depending on what level they were in, you know, the value of the chip went up. So there was some serious strategy involved with when to introduce the chips, whether or not to introduce the chips, and it helps you from getting coolered. You know, if you have a cooler, you have aces, he has kings, you get it all in, and you lose, hey, you still got these add-on chips left over. You're not out of the game unless you put the add-ons, because you could put them on at any time you want as long as the hand is not being dealt yet.
Yeah, so I guess just to explain it to people that don't know, you've got three extra add-ons.
You got two add-ons. Yeah, you get two add-on chips, yeah.
And you can cash those chips in whenever you want, and you get more chips. You can either just do them all at the beginning and just have a big, fat, happy stack.
Yep.
And when you're out, you're out. Or you can wait till you get felted and extend your life by cashing one of them in and getting a new stack.
Exactly. Correct? Exactly. Yeah. And the thing about it, too, is there's all this psychological warfare, I would think, that's going on. Because let's say you felt somebody, and then now you have all of their chips, plus you still have your add-ons. Now he's got only one add-on because he's got to put another one in play, and he's got a smaller stack than you already. So it's kind of like, it's sort of psychological warfare, and when do you bring him in? And if you have a massive chip lead and you still have your add-ons, should you throw the add-ons in now and make it look like, oh my God, look how many chips he has versus mine, or do you not put him at risk? And I just wonder, you know, are there multiple strategies here, or really just one strategy, and it's keep the chips out of play until you absolutely need them? I don't know, but it seemed like they did not use the chips at all until they got felted. You know that you have Jenny Timoshenko, a kid who won the WPT. I call him a kid because he really is young, and he looks like he's about 12. But he in one match suffered a a beat. It wasn't a bad beat, I don't think. I think he just lost a race or something. But he cashed in one chip where it gave him the same amount of chips as the other player on the table, even though he didn't need the cash in the chip because he wasn't felted. And I was thinking to myself, what's the right strategy? What are your feelings about that? What would you do, you think, when you're playing? And any scenario, really, just any scenario.
Well, yeah, I think it's what I'm intrigued by, and now I wish I would have watched it, so maybe I'll find it somewhere else, is how you use this heads up.
Yeah.
You know, in a multi-table, it's completely different. You know, you've got really two schools of thought. You got the guys that play an aggressive game and need to have a big chip stack, so they're going to just put all the chips on the table to begin with so they can bully people around and take shots like they normally do. And then you got little wimps like me who like to have lots of insurance on the table, and I'm just going to start with my existing stack, and that's going to allow me to take a shot at some point knowing that I can't be eliminated, and just put it in. But when you're talking heads up, it's completely different. So, you know, I think that scenario you just mentioned, I'm always worried when I play heads up when my opponent has more chips than me, because I'm at risk of going out.
Yeah.
So there might be a scenario, and a lot of this depends on how many chips you get, and you mentioned that it depends on the round or, you know, changes and stuff. So it's tough to say without actually knowing exact. But I would think there would be occasions when I would cash them in. Again, knowing I have two, so that changes a little bit. There might be an occasion where, you know, when I feel like I am being outplayed, maybe, that I'm going to want to cash one in before I get felted. So I'm even or above my opponent, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, as you mentioned, the cooler insurance, I would probably like to keep that second barrel in my Barney Fife gun for just that bad beat when I get short stack. But, you know, the interesting thing about heads up, too, it's probably not really shocking to our listeners because they know I'd love to play a short stack, but there's been a lot of heads up matches I've come back from, like, nothing.
Uh-huh.
You know, you get this thing in your mind where, hey, it's 1,400 to 100. And I got this person crushed. And guess what? A couple double ups, and that's gone.
Yeah.
It's completely different in a multi-table when you've got a bunch of other people playing and stacks moving around left and right. But, you know, there's really no insurmountable chip stack in a heads-up match. You know, if somebody just gets lucky on a couple hands, they're right back even with you. And talk about a momentum killer. That really hurts. And I've been in that situation on both sides, you know, where we're just one more hand, you know, push with anything and knock this guy out, and I got it won, and he wins, and then doubles up, and next thing I know, he wins the thing.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting that you brought, I thought the greatest point you made there was the fact that if you have a player that you know is better than you or outplaying you, you know, they always teach you to try to play big pots with someone who, you know, you want to get it in.
Yeah.
When you can. So if you cash in all your chips because you know this player is better than you, if I'm playing, you know, Doyle Brunson heads up, I know I'm getting my butt whooped, so maybe I do put all my chips on the table now and hope to felt him, and or at least get him to his chips so we're even, and I get that win that one big hand against him. And the other thing, too, is it kind of felt like the boxing three knockdown rule.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Because you had, okay, you knocked me out with one big punch there, but haha, I can stand up and get a standing eight count. Here's another stack. And then, oh, you knocked me down again. I got another standing eight count. Here's another stack. And so I keep coming at you, and you really have to knock the person out three times, it seems like, when you're playing heads up. Because these guys really hardly ever brought out the add-ons unless they were felted. And it made for some really dramatic TV, and I really thought there was some serious strategy. You know, the one thing that I was a little weary of bringing up today was this, because, you know, I felt like how many of us, including all of our listeners, really, are going to ever be in this situation? You know what I mean? I mean, how many places do you play poker where they're going to offer you, one, a heads-up tournament
to begin with,
to begin with, and then, two, they're going to dream up this add-on to extend these matches when, you know, most poker rooms are trying to turn over tables and turn a profit, and they're not equipped to do a heads-up properly. So when they do it, they're not going to want to extend these matches even longer. So, I mean, it's cool to talk about, and there is some thinking there, and maybe you happen to keep your add-ons, you know. But like in a regular multi-table tournament, you have to use your add-on at a certain period or pay for it at a certain period. So you can't hold it. So
much like any of the discussions we have on the show, you know, you're taking you can take something out of anything, even if it's something that it probably is never going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just the discussion we just had about when would you use them makes you think about how your heads-up game works.
Yeah.
So I think you still get value out of it. You're completely right. You know, I've played one heads-up tournament in a brick-and-mortar. There's been probably a half dozen other ones that I've seen offered in the 3 years that we've been in business.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen outside of the World Series and the heads-up championship for the most part. And to think that you're going to, you know, get a best 2 out of 3 match or these add-on chips, you're really asking a lot of the poker room for that. So,
and anybody
unless it's online, you know, I miss you so much. Yeah, you're right. I just don't think it's going to happen. But there's still value in talking about it.
So. No, I know. But I don't think that there are any listeners out there who have $25,000 burn a hole in their pocket who may enter this thing next year. If they did, they wouldn't really listen to our show. But yeah, I plus it was just an interesting concept, you know, and maybe someone, if you bring it to the, you know, the attention to whoever's listening, maybe it gets passed around to their poker rooms and maybe somebody does want to try it and then you would benefit from it. It was a lot of fun though. I enjoyed it. I wondered how they were going to do it, and they had the little graphic with like two little red dots or, you know, whatever, green dots or whatever they were next to their names to indicate that they had their add-on still, and it was pretty exciting. The guy who won, his last name's Cody, he's from England, and he had a really raucous crowd with him, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, the kid got hit in the head with a deck. He's a great player, obviously, but he got hit in the head with a deck on top of it. He blew away Gus Hansen, and Gus Hansen at that point had won 12 straight heads-up World Series matches because he had won the Europe bracelet, then came over here and made it to the semifinals, so he had won 12 in a row before he lost to that kid, and so for him to beat Gus, it was pretty impressive. It was a lot of fun, and I just... You know, it makes you think differently about when you have other options and you're playing heads up.
Well, a final thought too, I think, for the folks that brick and mortar rooms that do offer heads up tournaments, I actually like this triple chip idea rather than a best 2 out of 3.
Yeah,
it probably makes it go a little faster.
Yeah, you're probably right. That is a good idea.
And you know, because the big problem in the heads up is the variance. You know, anybody could beat anybody heads up in one time.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned how if you play Boyle Brunson, you're getting your fanny whooped, and you probably are, but you know, you shove every hand, you take away his skill, you know, turn it into a luck game. So you need to have that best 2 out of 3. And obviously that takes more time. But if you had the triple chips, then, you know, people might stack them all together at the same time. And so, you know, it's actually a real creative way of doing it. So
very cool.
You know, maybe that'll lead some rooms to actually try out.
We'll see.
I love this week's mailbag. And I shouldn't ever say that because that makes me feel like I don't always love our mailbag. But, you know, some writers just have the gift for gab and include a bunch of stuff. And what I think was funny about David Epstein's email they sent in this week is what we're talking about on the show was about 7 pages down in the email. And he actually had a line said, "Here's my question, finally." But I loved everything above it. And we'll have a little fun here before we get to the poker. You know, he was responding to, you know, we talked about card sharks on the show recently.
Yeah.
And he just wanted to remind us, Chris, that while Card Sharks is a great show, obviously, no one's going to argue that, Match Game 74 holds up much better from an entertainment point of view over the years. You know, Dave, I got to say this. I can't argue with it. Match Game 74 is classic. You know, if we ever get Fasto at a meetup, folks, you guys want to come and ask him about Match Game 74, he'll have you in stitches.
Gene Rayburn, baby.
Yeah. You know, because Fasto was old enough to actually be on the show. I don't think he ever was, but probably was in the studio audience trying to win one of those avocado green refrigerators.
Yeah, know. Yeah.
But, all right. Well, I hear you, David, on that. But, all right. So here we get into his real question here. We were also recently talking about, you know, the World Series Poker main event, the November 9. We have the Irish kid, son of his dad, also made the final table years ago.
Yeah.
First father and son duo ever to accomplish that. And it made him start thinking about second-generation players. And, you know, he went into this long discussion about baseball and football and, you know, how hard it is even in those kind of sports. But it's probably more difficult in poker. And so he wanted to say, other than, like, Joe Seabock and Todd Brunson, at this point, who else could be considered a well-known second-generation poker player? So we'll stop there. I mean, he's got a bigger question, but... Do any other second-generation poker players jump out at you?
I actually thought about this, and the only people I could come up with. And it's funny because I don't know if these O'Day people are considered famous. I know the father was like the best Irish one ever, but your good buddy Dewey Tomko and his kids.
Yeah.
That's the only one I could really think of that had, you know, unless you count Pam Brunson too or something. I don't know, but there are very few that we know of because they haven't done anything yet. You know, there might be a lot of kids out there playing because their parents play, but they may suck. You know, or they may not just be good enough to play. You know, like Pete Rose's kid. You know, he just never actually amounted to anything when he was in the bigs, and because he just didn't have his father's talent. And maybe that's happening all over the place, and we don't know it because they're not doing anything for us to, you know, to pay attention to. So I don't know. That's the only one I could think of. Could you think of any others?
All right. What about some reverse second or even third generation? You know, we I just talked to our good friend Lee Childs this week. Remember, he's going to be on our upcoming poker cruises, right?
Right.
He's bringing in his dad.
Yeah.
With him on this cruise, the year old dad is getting ready to turn 70, and his dad is a really good player in his own right. Obviously, Lee was the marquee player first, so his dad is probably catching up to him in terms of public notoriety.
Right.
I guess.
Right.
Not a poker player. And then what about Sean Deeb and Grandma Deeb?
Yeah, that's true.
Who wouldn't pay to see Grandma and Sean at the same final table of the World Series of Poker main event? He's slow rolling everywhere.
Slow rolling and rebuying.
And of course, that's third generation. There, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
But no, so in all seriousness, I'm sure there's some that we're missing. Nothing really comes to mind. But you're right. I think it's when we're talking about second generation poker play, we're not talking about just second generation of people playing. We're talking about people who have had some level of success.
Yeah.
Of different generations. And, wow, you would think some other would shoot at you. But to be honest, if, you know, Maury or some of the other TV producers are listening to the show, and I know they are, talk about it. You know, we hate made-for-TV poker, but this I might watch.
Yeah.
You know, you get the tag team there with two generations of players. That would be interesting. Well, maybe the reason it hasn't been done is because we can't think of any.
Well, they did do that, actually, on WPT. They had the fathers and sons on WPT. It was Todd and Doyle, and it was the Van Pattens, and then Seabach and Barry. I think those are the six. And I think they might have had other ones. I don't recall. It was years ago. But they did have a made-for-TV thing like that, father and son. So. But, you know, I didn't consider the Van Pattens good players to do something like this. So I didn't really consider them first and second generation good players. But other than those guys, really, that's all I could think of.
All right. Well, he goes on to say, my question to you two is, looking deep into the future, when you've just passed your 28th year of doing the podcast. Oh, man. Can you hear me? Believe that. So 20 years from now.
And we still wouldn't have missed a week either, I'm sure.
I'll be 26. You'll be 78. I don't know if we can still do it then. You passed your 28th year of doing the podcast. He says week after week, of course. Oh, thanks.
Yeah, of course.
Do you think we'll be talking a lot about second generation poker players doing well in the World Series of Poker? And how long before Andy Up Magazine has a stat page keeping track of second generation online players versus how their parents were doing at the same age? Now, I love this. It made me think of Rocky Balboa.
Yeah.
The last movie when he's got the little Looney Tunes thing on the TV, and they're, you know, they're trying to match up generations from generation. That's to me, that's even more fascinating than trying to think of second generation players, but trying to compare them in their prime.
Oh, geez.
Because poker has changed so much.
Yeah, you can't do it. It's like comparing Babe Ruth to Alex Rodriguez. You know, I mean, you just can't do it. Totally different situations. But, you know, you're assuming that there's actually going to be poker 28 years from now. With the way the government's going, you never know. They may even shut down just regular poker in your house. It's a good question. You know, I do think that a lot of these players think differently now. And when they have kids, I think that they'll want their kids to play and encourage them and teach them. And because they see that there's a lot of money in it and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of wealth in it. And let's face it, online poker is coming back at some point, and when it does, it's going to be right back to where it was with sponsors everywhere and everything. So, I mean, I do think that you know, I don't know if we'll be around for it, but I do think that you know the kids that like David Williams had a kid a little while ago, and you know, 20 years from now, his kid will probably be brilliant and probably play poker and So I think it'll happen. I don't know if we'll be tracking it, but yeah, if I think
it'll
happen.
A good point too. I mean, probably the reason we don't have a lot of second generation poker players right now that we can think of is, I mean, if you go back to all of the old school players, how many times have you read books or articles by them that said that, you know, they kept their poker playing private?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, they told people, hey, I'm an investor, or hey, I do this. I mean, because it didn't have that kind of cachet that it does now. And then also, you know, trying to be a professional poker player versus trying to be a professional baseball player, completely different, I think.
Sure.
I mean, I can't think of any professional baseball player that wouldn't encourage his son to try out to be a baseball player if he wanted to. But there are, obviously, I think, parents that that know what a grind professional poker playing is.
Yep.
And might try to encourage their sons and daughters to, you know, maybe not get into it the way they did.
That's a great point. Yep, that's a great point. Yeah, and the other thing, too, like you said, and a lot of the popular people now who have taken over the game are internet whiz kids who don't. It's mathematically impossible for them to have kids that are old enough to play poker right now. So we'd have to wait a good, you know, couple of decades, and I just don't know if we'll be around in a couple of decades. The magazine might be around, but we have been long gone and sold it to someone else by then.
I'm sure you have driven me off a cliff by then, so you might still be around.
We live in Florida. There are no cliffs.
Oh, that's right. Well, yeah, but we travel a lot.
So. That's true.
All right, Dave, we appreciate the multi-pronged email, and there's no way we couldn't give you any other piece of swag but an uncut sheet of J Design playing cards for that very long and very interesting email you sent us. J Design Playing Cards, of course, are the official playing cards of Antiope. You can only win the uncut sheets, and that's for the rest of the year on the show, by sending us something to podcast@antiopemagazine.com. But anybody, even if you're a second, third generation Antiope podcast listener, you can go buy the cards at the Antiope store at antiopestore.com.
Our hotline is 813-448-1120, and I love this next call.
Hey, guys. This is Greg in Bossier City, Louisiana. I noticed that I think Chris had said Bossier. I know we're French here in Louisiana, but it is pronounced Bossier. Come see us at the Horseshoe for the circuit event.
Who told you it was Bossier City, Chris?
That was you, man. That was you. Finally, I get to blame you for something and have it be true.
But you know what was the best thing about this? And I got to talk about this on the Short Stack Radio last night, because we were talking about, I think the host was asking me how we pronounce the person undercover, this issue.
Oh, yeah.
And I jokingly said, hey, that's the great thing about running a magazine. We don't have to know how to pronounce anything. We just have to know how to spell it. But when we get on the podcast, guess what? We got to know how to actually pronounce it. And here's the funny background story, Greg, and you're going to love this, is when I was doing the notes for that show, I wrote Bossier City, or Bossier City, as I would have called it, in the notes. And then I'm like, you know what? I think I'm just calling it Bossier City because I think that's what it is. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say Bossier City or another alternate pronunciation. So me, being the smart guy in this relationship, edited the notes to say it starts and ends in Louisiana, and I had to thank our good friends at the World Series of Poker Circuit event for making that easy for me, because the last event's in New Orleans, and this one event is in Bossier/Bossier City, and so I could get around it without actually having to set myself up. And, of course, I just chose not to tell my good friend and partner of my cleverness and let him walk right into it. Bulldoze right into Bossier City.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you keeping me in the loop. You know what? Screw it. I'm going to call it Bossier City anyway.
No offense to the residents of Bossier City, but come on.
I know.
If there's a better way to pronounce Scott, I would do it.
Besides, it's like the French capital of the United States, Louisiana. You would think that it'd be like Cloutier. It'd be Bossier, you know? So.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to say, hey, I live in Bossier City versus Bossier City? You know, we get no disrespect there, but I mean, maybe there should be a referendum there. Maybe Greg needs to get on the ball there and say, you know what? I think these Antiope guys are on something. They're completely misguided. They don't know anything about anything, but maybe they're on something here.
Bossier sounds like Dozier. I don't know. I like Bossier a lot better. It sounds classy. Not that Bossier City isn't classy, but
no, Bossier sounds big and tough. So I mean, there's advantages to both of them, but you know, I like to play with finesse rather than brute strength.
I'd like to make a Matrix reference here, but I won't. But everywhere, anyone ever seen it and knows the Merovingian, he talks about what it's like to speak French. He has a line in there where it's like wiping your butt with silk when you speak French. And it just, that's Bossier City is like wiping your butt with silk. I mean, it just sounds nice. So that's what we're going to call it. I'm not going to call it Bossier City, I don't think. I'm going to stick with Bossier. You know, I mean, how tough can they be in Bossier City that they can beat me up?
I don't know. I know right now, though, I'm not getting off a plane with you there. There's going to be some guys that are probably led by Greg with some baseball bats ready to show you how tough they are.
All right. Out of respect for Greg, I'll call it Bossier City.
All right, Greg, we're going to send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com. And I did call the wonderful Robin McCarty, owner and founder of PMS Pokerware, and she did confirm that I have been pronouncing it correctly.
All right, well, we brought up the podcast awards at the beginning of the show. Don't forget, you can go to checkraise.com. That's check, R-A-Z-E. .com and vote for Annie Up before August 15th for Poker Podcast. I guess is a podcast of the year. I don't know what it is, but for the best podcast. So, you know, we often hear from our listeners who say, you know, they want to help us if they can somehow, and this is a great way to do it, and it's free and easy. So, you guys want to go there and vote for us? We'd really appreciate it. Just do it before August 15th, and I think we're doing pretty well in the standings. I've looked at a lot of the comments and stuff, and we're doing pretty well. So, I'm encouraged, and I appreciate everyone doing it. So,
excellent.
Keep it up.
We would love to have another award to put up there because, you know, we're never going to win the Bluff Podcast Award.
Yeah, we can't win that one anymore, so.
All right, and then don't forget, and how is it possible that you could forget that we have Antioch Poker Cruises coming up again because we shill them like a cheap suit. Next one's August 29th, September 2nd. Probably a little too late for you to get on there, but give me a call even if you want to. We'll see what we can do. It's almost completely sold out, but hopefully I can still get you on for $369. And, but of course, we are selling left and right this winter cruise. We are out of suites already.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how fast we lost the suites.
December 1.
Yeah.
And not only are we out of them, there are only about a handful left on the entire ship. So this is going to be a popular stop. And so you're going to want to definitely call before our rate guarantee deadline of September 22nd to get on that one. That's going to be a 7-nighter going to Mexico, Jamaica, and Grand Cayman, leaving from the wonderful city of New Orleans. Or New Orleans, or
Nolens.
Yeah, in the great state of Louisiana. Hopefully, they allow us back in Louisiana after they find out that we have no idea how to pronounce any of their cities there. And don't forget that it's a normal Andy Poker Cruise, plenty of poker for men and women. But there will be a women's championship event on there, sponsored by Lips Tour. So a little extra incentive for the great women poker players that we know are out there to come sail with us.
You know, last week we introduced O'Malley's Move, and we need to play the first part again. We'll give our reaction, and then I'll play the second part. Now we're going to change it up a little bit this time, and now we're going to come back and give our final thoughts. So here's part one of O'Malley's Move.
Hello, and welcome to O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're sitting at a $1, $2 No Limit Hold'em casino cash game. We've been playing for quite a while, and currently have around $700 to our name. We're the second biggest stack at the table, as there is one stack nearing $800. Other than that, the closest stack to us has around $300. The blind's post, and it's folded to us in middle position. We look down at Ace of Clubs, Queen of Diamonds. With only three to act behind us, not including the blinds, we make the standard table raise to $15. It's folded to the button, who calls the $15. Our read on him is he is an action junkie who likes to get in and mix it up. He can't stop talking about how he hates playing 1-2 and can't wait for a spot on the 2-5 table to open up. He's only been there for about an hour, but has caused a strain on the otherwise friendly atmosphere. Straddling when under the gun, raising most every pot, and his favorite move seems to be getting to the flop with a small pair and trying to flop a set. He's busted one player doing that already. What's worse is he's the player with 800 behind. Small blind folds, big blind calls with about 185 behind. The pot stands at $46, and we see a flop of queen of hearts, five of hearts, three of clubs. Well, we couldn't have asked for much more. When you play ace-queen for a raise pre-flop and get called, you're really hoping to hit your queen, and that's exactly what happened. The big blind checks, not surprisingly, and it comes to us. Since we're the pre-flop aggressor and we hit our hand, we have to put in a bet here. The problem is the amount. Our opponent, who has us out-chipped, loves chasing draws and smooth-calling monsters, so we're not sure we can define his hand now. Any standard bet, one-half to three-quarters pot, would have him calling with any piece of it, and an overbet would just make us look desperate. But maybe that's what we want. At any rate, figuring the button will call, we settle on pot. Expecting this will only push the big blind out, we make it $45 to go. The button calls, the big blind folds, the pot is 136, and the turn brings the nine of clubs. So, we're first to act with 640 behind. Are we slowing down here?
So, Scott, do you continue to fire away here?
Absolutely. I don't want to get into a bluffing war with a crazy player like this. We've all played against players like this, and they are the worst players to play against because they're just so unpredictable. They're always going to put you to a decision. But here's the thing. When we hit a flop, even as light as we have here, you can't be scared anymore, or the guy is just going to really, really push you around the rest of the night. So maybe I'm a little light here, but I'm going to push a stack of red in the pot.
So you bet 100?
Yeah.
I agree, too. I think you have. I mean, and even it's not even really that light. I mean, you're top here, top pair, top kicker. So I would be comfortable betting about 120, try to protect my hand. Two to a possible straight could come on two different ways, and now there's also hearts and clubs. So I'm trying to protect what I've got out there from this guy hitting it. So if I don't bet, I'm giving him infinite odds to make any of these draws in case he's there playing him.
Yeah.
He is in position, so that could be part of his game plan. And if you don't bet, you know, you're giving them, especially a loose player like this, the green light to steal from you. So you have to fire here. I would say 120 or so.
120. All right. Well, from our forum at NAMagazine.com/forum, Amp88 chimes in. You know, I wonder, I think he's a Dale Jr. fan.
That could be it.
I just put that together last night when I was doing the notes.
Of course, that could be the year he graduated, like me. Or was born. That's possible, too. There's second generation for you.
See, we're not really good detectives here. So. Good thing it's O'Malley's Move and not the one-minute mystery. All right, anyhow, Amp88 says, fire away, baby. Actually, it doesn't say baby. I added that. It's better.
That sounds nicer.
All right, fire away. He says, there are now two flush draws, two straws out. Two
straws?
Out
wow.
There.
Straws
and
that
a
stir
straw
the drink.
To stir the drink. you need to make this man to pay to see if he will make a hand. My bet would be 175. Yes, I know it is greater than the pot, but I believe it will give us some options. If the opponent re-raises, we can fold since our opponent could have played queen nine, hit two pair. If one of the flush draws or straight draws hits, we could check behind if our opponent hits a hand better than top pair, top kicker. Make the guy pay to play. What do you think about that?
Well, let me ask you, are we out of position? We're out of position, right?
Out of position, right.
Yeah, so I wouldn't check behind. We can't check behind.
Yeah, that's true.
So that was the thing that threw me off there real quick. I don't know if I agree with betting more than what's in the pot, unless I'm just going to shove, but I have too much money, I think, to shove, so...
Well, what I'm wondering is, he mentions options.
Yeah.
I'm really worried if I'm going to push 175 into this pot and I'm going to fold to any raise to a guy that's capable of raising at any time.
Yeah.
On any board, I don't. That strikes me as weird.
Yeah, because why would you bet? Why would you lose $175 of your hard-earned money if you know you're going to fold to a raise?
Yeah, obviously there's times that you're putting out a feeler bet and if you get raised, you
right.
fold. I think this is too much of a feeler bet.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really what you're turning it into if you're saying, hey. I want to bet big, and if he raises, then I can fold. That's too big of a feeler bet for me. I would rather, you know, if you're going to put a feeler bet in, put 50 or something ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm not advocating that at all, by the way.
People, when they say they want to put when they say they have options, a lot of people, when they overbet, they're overbetting knowing that they're not going to fold. So they're giving themselves the odds to call an all-in or to go all-in eventually and not fold their hand. He's betting too much to say he can fold his hand. To me, that doesn't make sense to me. I don't want to do that. I want to bet as little as possible to where I'm protecting my hand but still getting my information. If it's a feeler bet, like you said, if it's going to be a feeler bet and that you're going to want to fold to a raise, then why would you bet so much? So I'm going to stick with my 120, and then if the guy does happen to come over the top, I'll make a decision then. I do think that if he does come over the top, I don't think he's bluffing. Okay. But who knows? We'll see. All right, well, I guess we'll hear part two now, and then we'll be right back.
Hello again. So what's the best move here? At this point in the hand, we're not willing to give up control to this maniac, and we're not quite ready to give up. His range is any pair, twos through tens, since he most likely would have raised our pre-flop bet with a pair higher than that. It's also likely that he has a flush draw, and we wouldn't even be surprised if he had a wheel draw to go along with it. Perhaps something like ace-deuce of hearts, ace-four of hearts. It's also possible that he could have flopped or turned a set. But we can't be afraid of any monsters under the bed. And if he does have a drawing hand, we have to make him pay to see it, and we can't make it cheap. With 146 in the pot, we make it 150 to go. Our thinking here is if it is a monster, now is the time for it to come out from under the bed. We can release our hand, and we'll still have 490 to play with. Plenty of money to see some flops and play our poker. If it's not a monster, he'll probably lay it down and we'll rake in a nice pot. The problem is, he just makes the call. The pot is 436 and the river is the 8 of hearts. This falls right in his wheelhouse. We tank for a minute and our thinking is along the lines of checking. Hopefully he'll check some overlooked missed draw behind and we can take this pot down with top top. But that's just wishful thinking. We could do some kind of value blocker bet, but if he does have the nut flush, which in this case would be the mortal nuts, we're just wasting any money we put into it. And the nut flush is right in his range. So, for better or worse, we decide to check. Our opponent thinks only for a few seconds before pushing 500 into the pot. It is an overbet. If we call and are wrong, we're broke. We tank for another minute or two, trying to find an excuse to call, but there isn't one. You should never go broke with only one pair, and you should never go broke with a queen in your hand. We're beat, and we know it. We muck our hand, flashing the queen, hoping our opponent will do the same. He looks at his hand, flashes us the five of spades, and then mucks. He must have flopped the set. Perhaps an all-in from us on the river would have got him to lay it down, but the best we can do is move on to the next hand. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley, and I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, here's the thing. I think it's tough to call off most of our stack on that river.
Yeah.
But the thing that you can't get away from in this hand, and we talked about already, is we're playing this pot out of position against a player like this, and when we get into that situation, it has tremendous risks.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do a lot about position. Obviously, you can't. I mean, you can ask for a seat change and stuff, but, it's really tough to play against a player like this out of position. And I think this hand illustrates it perfectly. You know, here we have top pair, top kicker, a card that we think kills us gets there. And so we check, and the guy puts a big bet in, and we fold, you know. I'm not saying it's a bad move, but I think that's going to be a move that happens pretty often.
You know, like you said, I think ultimately it was position that killed us here, not the strength of our hand. And you know, I don't really know if he's flashing that five to rub it in or if he's saying, I figured you just had ace-king and this is all I really needed. I know you couldn't fire three barrels, so here's the best hand, a pair of fives. I really think that he has a set, to be honest with you. Because that's so much money to bet on a bluff, you know, when you were showing strength the whole way. And yeah, he was waiting for a chance at weakness and whatever, but I feel like the guy probably had a set of fives. I don't see him playing 3-5 or queen 5 or 9-5. We really don't know what the last card was. We just said it was a heart. Yeah. So I feel like he has a set of fives, but I think the lesson here is be aware of your position and who you're playing against. when they have the power over you. And I don't know if we could have played it differently. I knowing this guy was going to shove on the river or bet that much on the river or whatever, maybe we do bet again because it's pretty safe bet that he. I mean, I guess he could have had hearts, right? Because the heart is the scary thing. The flush draw could have gotten there. But since he showed a spade, obviously he didn't have the hearts. I don't know. I felt like maybe a bet on the river was a smarter move. I don't know. I don't know. I can't see calling now. That's
yeah.
for sure.
Well, you know, this whole thing is making me rethink my, you know, my initial thought on the turn that we need to keep buying our way. I mean, one of the problems against a player like this is that you need to have a hand you're confident of beating. I mean, one of the real advantages of his style of play, and there's a lot of weaknesses, but one of his advantages is that he forces you to have a really good hand to be able to play back at him.
Yeah.
Or big cojones.
Right.
And if you don't have the you know, the big cojones, and I don't, that limits your options. So you know, maybe top pair, top kicker. I think that's why I mentioned that I thought it was light, even though it's not normally light. But against a player like this, it's pretty light. I would hate to check that turn, but you know, here's what happens: we put a bet on that turn. The river invariably gets there, and we're put to a test for almost all of our stack, and we end up having to fold. So.
Well, let me ask you this: so you check the turn, he bets 150, you fold with top pair, top kicker on a queen 9-5-3 board that has no draws there yet?
I'm not saying that necessarily. I have to think about that a little bit more. But, you know, maybe I'm paying his price rather than my price. You know, if he bets 500 on that time, I mean, then you got to make a decision. Actually, I probably would rather him bet 500 at that point than on the river. But I don't know. I mean, it's a tough hand to think through. I'm just thinking that if you get to the river and you know somebody's going to put 500 in regardless of what happens, and you're not going to be able to call that with top pair, top kicker, how much pressure do you need to put before that?
Yeah, you know, the other thing is that's when, again, position, you know, if you're in position here, a check behind the turn is fine because you're controlling the size of the pot. I mean, you would like to protect your hand because of the whatever, but you can also dictate, you know, if you were going to bet 120, you could check and then call the 120 on the river because he's probably going to bet that on the river, try to steal it from you, but he might not play out of position against you. So it's such a – so many invariables here. I don't know I don't know how you could have played it differently. I don't like checking the turn there. I just don't. He's going to steal it from you there. Totally gives him the green light. Just take it from you right there. And if you call and then check again on the river, he's going to bet again on the river, and then you fold. So it puts you in the same position.
I guess that's my point, though. I mean, that's the genius in how the style of play is. You know, you just really don't know. I mean, here's the thing. At the end, obviously the heart comes, and we don't like to see that because we think that's, you know, completely could have completed his hand. But he didn't need a heart there to beat us. Two pair is good enough to beat us. And so you got, I mean, the heart just makes it easier for us to fold. But if it wasn't a heart and he made that bet, I mean, is it that much easier to call? Your top pair, top kicker?
Yeah, it's tough.
When you put him on a range where he could have two pair with any of these cards. So I guess that's what I'm saying. It's just, it's a real tough way to, you know, it's just a tough opponent to play against out of position. In position, completely different.
Here's another train of thought. You could take up roulette. And not have to worry about this anymore. Just play your favorite numbers and hope they come out.
Well, I'll be interested to see what folks say on the AnnieUpMagazine.com/forum here. We threw out a lot of crazy stuff there, mostly me. but I'll be interested to see. I mean, really, the end of this episode is really how do you play against a maniac?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good topic to discuss in more detail on the forum.
All right, so what are some of the topics on the AnnieUp News Desk this week?
888 Holdings, a British online poker operator, is in, quote, advanced stages of considering whether to apply for an online poker license in Nevada in partnership with Caesars Entertainment. This comes from Bloomberg News. The two companies already have an agreement that led 888 to get a software services license in Nevada 2 years ago.
That's interesting. You could probably help me with this, but I wonder why Caesars would need them at all anyway. I mean, what does Caesars need 888 for?
Well, you know, I guess it's the first to the market kind of thing.
Okay.
I would think the folks at Caesars have been working on their own online poker platform for a while. But I believe, you know, obviously they've had this deal with 888 before on the software side of it for a couple years. And maybe they just said, hey, it's easier to partner with somebody who knows what they're doing and also has name recognition around the world. And let's not forget that while the World Series brand is worldwide, Caesars Entertainment is really mostly an American brand.
Yeah.
And 888 is obviously very well known over the pond. So, you know, it just might be a marriage of convenience. You know, hey, you find somebody that already knows how to do it, and we take a little less money, but two giants coming together, you make a lot more money than two of them battling separately. So maybe that's what's going on. I don't know.
Okay. 888, I know that they also were part of that Pacific Poker. That's where I made all my money when we first started playing. I miss Pacific Poker, man. Okay, Fair Play USA, a new advocacy coalition, has been formed to educate policymakers and the public ambiguous internet gaming laws in the United States. Board members include former Pennsylvania Governor and Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge and former world champion Greg Raymer. Like how I pronounce all his big words? Thanks for giving me that one, buddy.
Yes, yes, yeah. I threw ambiguous in there and then purposely left a word out there, and you fell right into the Bossier City trap, buddy. You know, I'm spending a little time trying to figure out what exactly this group is trying to do. I mean, obviously, with a name like Greg Raymer, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, I immediately give it some credence. But that credence is somewhat mitigated by Tom Ridge, which seems like an odd person to have involved.
Yeah.
Just you know, well-known government, you know, executive both on the state side and the federal side. One thing that kind of threw me off a little bit is that they wanted to be sure that illegal gaming sites are immediately shut down. And they didn't go into a lot of detail on what they thought about that. But, you know, I don't really know what constitutes an illegal gaming site.
Yeah.
This is the crux of this whole Black Friday argument, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we just, the last thing we need is one more group that's trying to corner the market on competition. So I just hope that's not the case.
I know.
It doesn't seem like it.
Why can't they just join together? Why do they always have to have their own groups that we have to get all this stuff run by or you know, submitted by? And why can't they just all come together and say, you know what, Fair Play USA, why don't you just go with the PPA and, you know, UAMGA or whatever the hell those things, you know, it's just weird.
I know what you're saying, but I mean, why create Annie Up when Card Player's already out there?
Well, are they making money?
Seriously,
though? I mean, they're an advocacy group. They're not making money.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, they're making money for the board members.
I guarantee you that. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, there's differences of opinion in the marketplace. So I know others. They different groups need to split off. But I think you're right. I mean, to the degree that they can work together on a common goal would be wonderful.
Right.
All right, well, finally, the Delaware Park Poker Room has filed paperwork with the Guinness Book of World Records to attempt to set the record for the, quote, longest continuous poker tournament, Chris. The room's Ironman event on August 20th is expected to last 36 hours with only minimal breaks for players. I assume that Iron Women are allowed to enter as well, too.
Yeah, we ran a little bit of this in the magazine, not about the Guinness thing, but the actual Ironman event, and I thought, wow, that's crazy. I mean, that's going to be exciting, but not in hour 36, it won't be. People are going to be like, I call.
Yeah, you know? We mentioned that not the first room to do this. I think Commerce has done one in the past. It did sound like they tweaked the structure a little bit to try to make sure it hit 36 hours so it wins the record. So, man, that's a long time to be sitting at the table. I think they bring you food and stuff, but if you want to take a nap or a shower or smoke or anything, you gotta do it and skip some rounds.
Well, you know, when you're trying to attempt a world record, and we may have some news on this someday too, but you know, they let you pool your breaks, so you're allowed a 5-minute break every hour or every 2 hours or something. So if you wanted to, you could wait 10 hours and then take a 50-minute nap or something. So I don't think they'll let you do that in this, because the tournament has to keep going. So, you know, and it's no skin off Delaware Parks knows, because, you know, they'll just keep letting their dealers shift changes, and they'll bring in fresh dealers all the time who've gotten their naps and gone home and everything. But the players themselves, they can't just take a break, you know. It should be interesting.
This is Joe Seabock, and you're listening to Any Up.
The Tournament Directors Association, or the TDA as it's most commonly known, recently concluded a rules summit in Las Vegas, and Nick Cavarella, a poker industry veteran, TDA member, and longtime reader and contributor to Anteup, attended the summit and joins us today to fill us in on some of the issues that more than 140 tournament directors from around the world discussed recently. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Yes, it's good to be here, guys.
All right, well, first, you know, many of our listeners are familiar with the TDA and its rules, but for those who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about the organization and what it does?
Well, first of all, the organization was founded in about 10 years ago, in 2001, and the board of directors, Matt Savage, Linda Johnson, David Lamb, Jan Fisher, they are still the board members. And I believe after this year's summit, Mike Bishop was also added. Now, anyone that's familiar with the TDA on the discussion forum will be familiar with Mike Bishop. I mean, he's kind of the go-to guy. He does everything. There were 140 participants. They weren't all tournament directors, however.
Okay.
But it was the biggest crowd that they've ever had there. It was interesting. Plus the fact that it was held at the Rio while the World Series of Poker was going on. So it was a nice place to be for a poker player.
Well, specifically, what does the TDA do for folks on a regular basis? I mean, as far as giving folks a consistent rule base, right?
Yeah, what they're trying to do, I'm going to read this. The Poker TDA is comprised of poker room personnel from around the world whose objective is to draft a standardized set of rules for poker tournaments. Now, this is key also because, you know, every once in a while we'll get someone on the discussion forum and they're going to have questions about poker-related issues, but they're not tournaments. And there's a big difference between tournament play and ring games or cash games. I mean, I know you guys play a lot of poker, and you probably play both cash games and tournaments, for sure. But the rules, specifically the TDA, is for tournaments. So when you come across a rule that has, it might have a it's not going to have a different meaning, but it's not going to pertain to a cash game. It would be tournaments only because all players in a tournament have a vested interest in the outcome of the tournament, and I think that's the main reason why.
Well, this TDA summit was a pretty big deal. How often do you guys hold these things, and how often do you update the rules? I mean, is it something we need to keep track of every year, or once we get them down pat, you know, we'll have to wait a while before another update comes?
They get together every 2 years, and they set the rules. Now, it seems like every other summit, what they'll do is they'll have a standardized set of rules, and then the next time they have the summit, they wind up making some adjustments to the other ones from the previous summit. But this year, they've introduced more than they ever have in the past. 2009 was more of a, like, kind of tweaking the rules from the summit in 2007. But this year, they're adding quite a few new rules, and I was really anxious to see them, and I'm sure they're going to be out any day now. But I can tell you pretty much some of the big issues that were gone over. Substantial action was one that always seems to be, everyone always has questions about substantial action. And what substantial action is, they were trying to get the right definition of substantial action. You'll see where a player is skipped, and then one player acts out of turn, and then there's a chain reaction. Another player acts, and another player, another. Well, what we're trying to determine is what constitutes substantial action. You know, how many players do you need to act before you can back up a bet or enforce a penalty or, you know, whatever. One of the issues that I had, and I have to tell you, the job that these tournament directors do, first of all, they do not get paid, okay? So they do it for the love of the game, I would say. The tournament directors, the board of directors, Matt Savage, Linda, Dave, and Jan, this is their set of rules. They really don't need to come to us and ask how we feel about things. So, you know, in that respect, I got to give them an awful lot of credit, because these rules are so difficult for players to deal with. Every situation seems to be a little different. It gets to the point where you're going to have rules that seem to conflict with each other. I'll just give you one that was a big item of discussion. They have an unwritten rule, at least I have not seen it in the TDA or anywhere else. It would probably be under a category of proper etiquette, where an all-in player, even if he leaves the table, his hand is not dead. In other words, let's say you're in a hand and you know you don't have much of a chance after you see the flop and you're all in and there's still action going on, you get up and you're on your way out. You're heading out to the parking lot. Well, many of the TDA members during this discussion felt that in the best interest of the game, if that player had the best hand, he should be awarded the pot. Well, there are other TDA rules that say that a player must stay in their seat. So, I mean, you know, what's it going to be? If you're in the seat, I mean, I know me personally, if I'm playing and I have any interest at all in the pot, I'm certainly not going to leave the table.
Right.
You know, that was one issue. I mentioned that the summit went on for 2 days, and I will say this, 2 days is not enough. And to answer your earlier question about the rules and how long it takes them, what they're going to do, when they come out with the rules, it's going to be like the 2011 TDA summit rules, like 1.0, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they're going to kick that around on the discussion forum. You know, we're going to be going back and forth, and I guarantee you, whatever rule they come up with, there is going to be discussion and there's going to be disagreement. I mean, it was evident, even between the four board members, we're having a tough time agreeing on a lot of the rules. So it's really tough. What I wanted to do was, I don't know if defend is the right word, but I really want to defend the dealers, because that's what I do now. I still train dealers. And a lot of these tournament directors, because of the huge tournaments that they're dealing with, they face situations that, frankly, I would not have any interest in attempting right now. I mean, the numbers are staggering. And most tournament directors or floor personnel will not deal with these types of numbers in tournaments. And there was a lot of discussion on like players on the bubble. There wasn't really time to cover all 44 of the existing rules that they had from 2009. So consequently, because of it, some were skipped, and I know some people were a little disappointed that, you know, everything wasn't touched on. But I can tell you this, as long as those people are on the board of directors, the best interest of poker tournaments around the world is always going to be served. I mean, they're dealing with procedures from even in this country, from state to state. You'll find that procedures are different. You know, placement of cards. They've got the automatic shufflers. They've got the Bravo systems. They've got it's really tough. And I'm trying to stay on top of it, because when I train the dealer, you know, placement of the cards on the board is very critical.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching Heads Up Poker. In fact, I was watching it a couple days ago on TV, and I noticed, now this might not seem like an issue, but when you walk up to a poker table and you look at the five community cards that are on the board, you always assume that you know what was the flop to turn in the river, correct?
Right.
I mean, you would think. Well, what I'm going to tell you now, when you watch Heads Up Poker or some poker tournaments from Europe, or even if you think of some of your more popular sites when you were playing poker online. The flop, turn, and river come out backwards. In other words, I'm sitting at a poker table, and when I put the three-card flop on, it goes from my left to my right, the dealer.
Mm-hmm.
The ABC card. Okay, now, you guys think about it, and not all of the sites, but most of the major sites, when you think about it, now you've got your dealer on the top of your screen, correct?
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And they usually, the flop usually goes from left to right, which is incorrect. In other words, it's a technical thing, and it maybe to some people it isn't a big deal. But if you're teaching somebody and you tell them, well, here, you watch this and you'll learn, well, they're not going to learn. and the TV, for the TV now, because the dealer is sitting where he is and they have the camera on the opposite side of the table, but yet somehow someone somewhere decided that they should still put the flop left to right. So consequently, what the dealer does, he actually puts the three-card flop down in the center, and he sweeps it from the center of the table to the right. And then when he puts the turn out there, it's to the left of the three-card flop, which is incorrect, and then the river. So what's the big deal? The big deal is if you look at the board when all five cards are there, in a normal situation, I should be able to tell you what the flop to turn the river is. And you're wrong. You'd be wrong if you were watching it. They're just little, you know, like I said, I'm here more or less to represent a dealer, because when I teach a dealer and I tell a dealer that under no circumstances whatsoever, unless it is at the explicit request of the owner of the hand, do you turn over a player's hand? First of all, the player is seated at the table, and if it's their responsibility at the showdown, there's an order of showdown at the end of every hand that the card should be shown. And if, in fact, it's a tournament and the player does not comply, what are the options? I mean, I want to see your hand. As a dealer, I'm going to maybe point with an open hand, like it's your turn to expose your hand, okay? And you refuse to do so. Now, what options does a dealer have? If another player wants to see the hand, the rule of thumb is, in a cash game, they would pick up the two release cards from the owner of the hand, touch those cards to the muck so they're technically dead, and then you could turn them over because that player had a right to see the hand if it's a called hand. In a tournament, this is one of the issues. Well, my argument is, if the owner of the hand doesn't turn the cards over, who's going to turn the hand over? Now, I'm waiting for the TDA rules to come out because I'm talking about this because this is something that I know is an issue that's going to be brought up. And I have no argument if, in fact, they make a rule that states in a situation where an all-in player refuses to turn over his hand at the showdown, the dealer must kill the hand first and then expose it to the table. In case, now they do this for reasons of collusion.
Right.
You know, and chip dumping and things like that. But those are things that take place, like I said, in tournaments. And, you know, I don't want to just voice my opinion and some of these rules, but I will say this. Anyone that follows the TDA, and if you ever go on the discussion forum, if I have something that I strongly believe in, as far as a dealer, like I'll give you that I talked about it a little bit before, substantial action. If you have a good dealer in the box, that error is not even going to take place.
Right.
It's not going to happen. I mean, if the bet's on Chris and Scott, you're sitting, so Chris is in the four seat and you're in the five seat, and for some reason you skip Chris and Scott comes out with a bet. If I'm dealing, I'm going to say, hold on a second, Scott, it's Chris's bet.
Right.
Okay, I solved the problem. Now, how does substantial action happen? If Chris is hiding his cards under the table or behind his chips, now we've got a different issue. But my argument is there are other rules on the TDA also, out of turn. Now, who's the offending player? Many times in these discussions, when a player gets skipped. Now, here's what happens. Let's say that Chris, you're in the four seed. For some reason, you get skipped. The five seed bets. The six seed calls. Now, I believe that's what they established as substantial action. Two players putting chips in the pot. Now, that's not the whole new rule, but that I'm quite positive is going to constitute substantial action. Now, what happens if Chris says, hey, you skipped me? All right. The betting goes around in the proper rotation, and when it comes to Chris in the four seat, he can only call or fold. In other words, he can't sandbag and say, oh, gee, it was my bet. I'm sitting here holding a nut hand, and Scott bet, and now I'm going to get all these players in, and now when it comes back to me, I'm going to raise. See, that's why it's designed like that, skipping mm-hmm. the player. But if we back it up, why was the player skipped? And how can you blame the skipped player? I mean, if a player is skipped, the next player that acts, he's the offending player initially. He's the out-of-turn player. Why did he skip that player? And then if the dealer condones that, in other words, the four seed is skipped, the five seed bets, the dealer says to the six seed, it's 200 to call. Now you've got three persons, at least. The first offender is the out-of-turn bettor. The next, I put the blame on the dealer, and then I put the blame on the skip player for not saying, hey, it was my turn to bet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So who do you penalize? And I can tell you what, guys, it boils down to knowing players in a game and the intent of the player. When you get repeat offenders, this makes a huge difference. There are so many delicate technical issues that the tournament directors have to deal with. It's really overwhelming. And you have to have your eyes and ears as a tournament director on the incident when it takes place. Believe me, it's not all cut and dry. They talk about verbal is binding when you're making a bet. Okay. You get a player that's pushing his stack forward and at the same time announces an amount. What are you going to hold him to? It's like what happened first. Or a player that's reaching forward with a stack of chips in his hand, and as the chips hit the table, he says an amount. Now, verbal is binding. If I say 100 and then I push out 200, I'm held to the 100. Okay? But if I push the 200 out and it goes out first and then I say 100, I'm held to the 200. Now, who's going to be there to take that photo, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's you know, a lot of situations, and I can tell you this, many of us have the luxury of watching these poker hands played out on YouTube or, you know, you see them all the time. And they're rehashed over and over and over and over again. Well, when you're a tournament director, number one, half the time you don't see it. And, you know, you have to make an instant decision. You have to make a decision. I mean, you're not going to hold up the whole game. You got to make a pretty snap decision on information that you receive from your dealer and then from the players. But, listen, guys, I mean, I could go on and on.
Well, it's pretty clear why it took 2 days, and 2 days wasn't long enough. We could talk about this forever. There were some other things that happened, though. I know that there was a clarification on something to do with stack sizes and stack tidiness and whether or not...
Yeah, that's something, too, that, you know, almost every subject that was brought to the table was kicked around so much. That's what I was saying. There was so much time spent on some things. And that's one of them. I mean, you watch poker on TV. Now, for the average person in the average, you know, small-time tournament, you're not going to see the stacks, the enormous stacks of chips that these guys have in the World Series of Poker.
But, right.
You know, so how do you say you have to have your stacks and your chips and stacks of 20? I mean, wow, you know, it would be almost impossible for one thing. I watch these guys and they go up 20, 40, 60, you know, but the fact that you've got piles and piles, it's not one stack going up, you know.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how you can force that. I understand why they want to do that, because it's easier for players, opposing players at least, to see, to get an idea how many, you know, what the bet is they're going to have to call, how much the opposing player has. This is all important, you know. But whether they finalize that or not, I don't know. Some of them suggested, you know, like 20s, but and then like 20 and then another 20. I don't know if they were going to separate them by color, or I really don't know how you're going to do it. There were many things that they discussed that I was in favor of, and tournament directors should have a right to reduce or
color up,
exactly, you know. And there's some players, no, I like, they like a whole bunch of chips on the table. Well, you know, it really shouldn't be their call.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, to keep their stacks manageable, and if you want to enforce a 20-chip rule, it's going to be on the floor people or the tournament directors to stay on top of all that kind of stuff, though, and it's going to give them even more responsibilities and less time to make important decisions somewhere else, though.
Oh, that's exactly why they want to do it, and it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, what we're talking about are written rules, and people want to see it in writing. So that's what they're trying to do, and they're trying to come up with a good idea that certainly has, you know, merit, and it makes a lot of sense. But even when tournament directors feel that this is what they want to do, and they go to a table and they say, "Hey Johnny, you know, let me color those up." No, I don't want to, because every time I do that, I lose. So, you know, they kind of back up, and it's like, gee, what can I hit this guy with? You know, I want to show him something in writing. You know. You can't just keep throwing, you know, well, I'm the boss, and this is the way it's going to be. So this is where they're going, I think, with a lot. And they should. You know, they should have that right. I think, and it's a real simple deal. Why would players complain? I have a feeling that as long as you know going in as a player, look, these are the rules. You play by the rules. This is a betting line. Some casinos don't have them, but you put your bet out too short, it's not going to count as a bet until you cross the line. Okay, how many times do they have to tell you that? It happened to me the last time I was in Las Vegas when I was playing. I just pushed my, I thought I pushed them out far enough, and they said, "Sir, that's not a bet." You got, "Oh, okay." So I pushed it out another 3 inches, and I was good. But how many times do they have to tell you? One should be good enough.
Yeah.
One of the other rules that sounds like generate a lot of debate is discussing action at a turn and what happens, you know, trying to find out when action is binding and when a player is released from his out-of-turn declaration. What can you tell us about that debate?
Yeah, that's always going to be a delicate issue. That, you know, out-of-turn action, we talked about it a little bit before. Out-of-turn could induce substantial action. Now, I say could because there's a lot of times in games when there's not that many players in a game. I mean, when you have two players, it's kind of hard to define substantial action. At least I find it is. You know, if player A is supposed to bet and player B comes out with the bet, well, what are the options to A? Hey, hold on a second. You know, we're playing head-to-head. He bet out of turn. Now, there's rules that say that the action, the player that bets out of turn, as long as the action isn't changed to him, his bet stands. Well, you know, there's a lot of angle shooters that could take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these rules, they have to be really, really, it depends on whether a player is all in. Many rules are different for head-to-head players. Like as far as conversation. Now, you want to talk about out of turn. A player that bets out of turn, why did he bet out of turn? Why was he betting out of turn? Did he intentionally skip a player? Now, I know what happened to me. I was sitting in a one seat. This was a full table. And I didn't see the player in the 10 seat because the dealer in the box was obstructing my view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So a player in the 9 seat made a bet, and I made a raise. And instead of the dealer correcting or stopping it, the player beyond me reacted. Now, he could have done anything. He happened to fold. But if he, let's say he called or he raised, now that's substantial action. And we skipped that player in the 10 seat. But what happened was the player in the 10 seat raised the player in the 9 seat. So I wanted to withdraw my bet. I didn't see that player, you know. And if the dealer had stopped it in time, by my definition of substantial action, I should have been able to retract my bet. But in most tournaments, they won't allow it. It's always a controversial issue. I always like to look at the intent of the player. Hey, it was an accident. Now, if I keep making the same accident, then it's not an accident anymore.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
But what I do as a dealer, and I always go back to the dealer because I put the blame, almost all of the blame I put on the dealer, because a good dealer is going to stop that from happening. And I can tell you this, when I was dealing, and I would tell a player in the one seat, don't do anything, I'll tell you when it's your turn to act.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Nick, thanks. So now the player in the 10 seat action, I'll look to him and I'll say, it's up to you. Simple.
Yep.
It's simple. Don't do anything until I give you the signal. But a lot of the tournament directors right now, because of the poor quality of some of the dealers in these enormous number of tournaments, that when they've got hundreds of tables in these tournaments, you know, you're not going to get the best dealers in the land when they're only going to be hired to deal one day. And as the tournaments break down, they're gone. So consequently, some of the floor personnel and tournament directors are leery about having the dealers do anything. And they want to take the responsibility away from the dealers. And I really don't think they should do that. They should just get better dealers. You know, poker is a big business. You have to put a good product out there that goes from the cards, you know, the tables that you use, the equipment, and the dealers. So out of turn is, you know, to get back to out of turn. Out of turn is very serious, but you have to look at the reason why. Like I said, if there's a player that's trying to deceive someone by hiding his cards behind his chips, well, isn't that the dealer's responsibility, too, to tell him, sir, you have to have your cards in front of your chips so they're visible to everybody? Okay? I mean, if there's a player out there that's trying to do something that they shouldn't do, I hate to use the word cheat, but in a sense, that's what it is. If there's a player out there that's going to do that, and it's sneaky, they know all the angles, well, first of all, who needs them? I don't want them in my card room, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's another issue. But out of turn, you have to look at why the player bet out of turn. If a player is induced by the dealer to act out of turn, Chris, when you're playing, if I was in the box dealing and I said, Chris, it's on you, it's 100, and you put $100 in, and you found out that the guy bet 300 in front of you, why should you be obligated to keep your 100 in?
Right.
You know? You wouldn't be, right?
No, and that happens, stuff like that happens a lot, where they say, no, you should always be sure of what the action is yourself and don't rely on the dealer. We had a call to floor like that a little while ago, might have been in the magazine too, where, you know, yeah, ultimately it still falls on you to know what the legitimate bet was or whatever. So you were mentioning having better dealers, but I don't know if I still want to empower dealers to that point where what they say stands.
I'm not saying, first of all, a dealer that's dealing like in a limit game, now that's a different story. You know, if you're dealing in a 10 and 20 game and you're on a $20 betting round, and a player bets 20 and next player says raise, I can go to the next player and say it's 40. I mean, that's all it can be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about no limit and pot limit, that's a completely different thing. It's completely different. That's like an unclear bet, you know?
Yeah.
But one of the biggest issues, and I don't know if this is on your list, but it's accepted action. This is the one that I think we discussed this more than probably anything. And it's a brand new World Series of Poker rule that was introduced in 2011. It started out as Rule 89 in the WSOP, and then it went to 91 for some reason. But it states poker is a game of observation, and the responsibility of the bet falls on the player that's the calling player. They should know. Even if given the wrong information by the dealer or another player. Now, you know, to go back to what you said about, I don't want to rely on the dealer. Okay. You don't want to rely on the dealer when there's an amount, a specific amount, let's say, and he's going to give you an inaccurate count. But let me ask you this. Scott, you're playing in a game, and Chris makes a bet, and Chris says, I bet 2,000. Okay? And you, and the deal, I'm dealing, and I say, Scott, it's 2,000 to call. And Scott says, okay, I call 2,000. Scott pushes 2,000 in the pot, and guess what? We count it down, and it's 3,000. The way that rule is written, you, Scott, are liable for the other 1,000 because you have the responsibility, and I don't like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was dead against that rule the way it was written. And listen, there were many, many, and I know Matt Savage is one, that really wanted to introduce that rule as a TDA rule, and I was really hoping that it would be out there today so we could kind of go over it the way that they have it worded. Because I was kicking it around, and I can understand if a player makes an insta call, most of the time he's going to call anyway. Like,
right.
Okay, I'm all in, call. Okay, who cares?
And right.
Then, you know, now you got to count it down. But at some point, don't you have to count every bet down that's called?
All right.
My argument is, if player A makes a bet, and the dealer and the other player says, how much is that? Now, the dealer can't tell him. The dealer can't tell him. What the dealer can do is reach over and break down the stacks so the player that's considering calling can eyeball it and get a pretty good idea at how much the bet is, and then it's his responsibility to make an accurate call. Now, I'm all for that, okay? But my feeling is, in TDA rule number 30, the last line of the existing rule is, players have a responsibility to make sure their actions are clear. So now, you want to come in with a brand new rule that's going to take all of the responsibility away from the betting player and put it all on the caller. I don't agree with that. I think that poker is certainly a game of observation, like they said, but poker is also a game that requires mutual participation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if player A says, I'm going to bet 300, and player B says, is that 300? And I'm checking it. I personally, guys, I don't see anything wrong with that. Okay? I don't see anything wrong with it. The rule has to be rewritten. I can't see it standing the way it was written this year for the World Series of Poker. I understand where a calling player should have a responsibility, but especially if a player doesn't request. If I'm going to call a bet and I ask the dealer, is that right? And I ask the player and we go over it, and why not count it then?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what's it going to come to? Well, he said he bet 2,000. Now, I'm going to call him if he bet 2,000. You know? I mean.
Well, the thing is, though, is that these rules are in place because of, you know, we need to have rules in case there are dealer errors or player errors, and that's what we need to have them to look up and go by to make a decision. Yeah, you can always say, why not have a perfect situation and why not have a perfect robot dealing or whatever, but, you know, dealers are going to look up at the sports game. They're going to sneeze. They're going to, you know, whatever, and they're going to lose concentration for a minute or something, and something like this can slip by in a moment's notice. So that's why the rules are there, though. I mean, you keep going back to the dealer should be doing these things properly, but that's why these rules are there, right? I mean, that's what we're doing them for.
Oh, I agree 100%. And, you know, and like I said, in defense of the tournament directors and the TDA and what they're doing, I'm on their side. I want to do it. I think of many of the rules that are out there, because they don't want to make them real long and real, you know, like some of the other rule books, you know, they're endless.
Right.
But there's a couple words in some of them, and they know it too, that makes the difference, you know? there's a couple things there that just, you know, we got to figure out the right wording, because if I read a rule to you and Chris interprets it one way and you interpret it another way, you know, I mean, wow, you can go back to rule number one, which is the decision of the floor man is final. You can only do that so many times. What I'd rather do, I mean, you know, and it's funny because if you go online and follow some of these, like the Hendon Mob or even the discussion forum on the TDA, it is absolutely amazing the difference in opinion on tournament directors on the exact same situation. It's amazing, you know. It really is. So what you say is true. My question on that accepted action is, what in the world could have happened? What happened in the World Series of Poker to make them think that a rule like that is needed? I want to know what the situation was. This isn't a little substantial action thing. This is, hey, if you make a call, you better know how much money you're calling. Okay? End of story. It's not the dealer's fault, and it's not the bettor's fault. It's your fault. And I just kind of think that, look, there's ways angle shooters can certainly get around that. How many times have you guys played in a game, because I know it's happened to me hundreds of times, how many times have you played in a game where you called the bet and you misunderstood the bet?
Right.
I
mean, come on. It's like a guy bets 2,000 and you thought he bet 200 and you raise, so now you're committed to 4,000? Wait a minute. You know, I mean, there's situations where a guy bets $20. The next guy makes it 600. And then the guy after him says raise, make it 40. He completely missed the $600 better.
Right.
Now, are you going to hold him to that? This is where substantial action comes in and a good dealer. And to back it up as far as out of turn, who's the offending player when a player gets skipped? Most of the talk on the discussion forum, once substantial action takes place, they want to kill the player's hand that was skipped. They don't even want to give them the option. They want to, hey, you let three players bet after you, your hand's dead. I don't know how you do that. The only way I've ever done it is if I burn and turn the next card, now his hand is dead because he can't see a card that he didn't pay for. Okay?
Well, you know, a couple of big-name pros showed up, Dan Ugranu and Barry Greenstein, that we know of, and they addressed the summit. What were some of the issues they had or they felt were important?
Well, Daniel Ugranu, he kind of surprised me because he was talking about a structured game or a limit game, for one thing. And he mentioned a player that was, he thought he shouldn't have been able to do what he did. They were playing 30-60, let's say, if I can recall this. And on a $30 betting round, the player bet 60. And the next player said raise and put out, I'm not sure Daniel, you know, stated it correctly, but I got the gist of what he was trying to say. And he said, and the next player wanted to raise, but the initial bettor said, well, no, he can't make it that because he could only bet three. How could he bet six, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, come on. You know, there again, I'm going to look at the dealer and say, hold on a second. The bet's 30. Now, if the next guy raises, he's locked into a $60 bet.
Yeah.
I was surprised that he brought it up because of the limit game. I mean, in a no-limit game, it can get very complicated. But, you know, limit, you can't back out of that bet, number one. You know, if I put $9,000 out there and we're on a $3,000 betting round, it's $3,000. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else I can do. I don't have any other options. It's unlike some other games.
All right, Nick. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today, and thanks for the update. And again, it's pokertda.com if they want to check up on the rules and go to discussion forums. Thanks, Nick.
All right, folks, we taped that interview with Nick last week before the final rules were announced, and after looking them over, we decided we had to chat a little bit more about some of them now, Chris. Couldn't wait till next week. I had to get it all in now, so I know people just can't get enough of the TDA. I mean, seriously, we get a lot of questions. Our call to the floor is real popular, so I know the stuff is curious to him. And one of the things I noticed when I read through were a lot of these changes this year. There were things that we've talked about on the show in one form or another, so ought to be interesting here. But in order to fit it on here and not make this show worthy of 7 round trips to work, we're going to skip the hand of the week. Remember to email your hands to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and you too might win some great swag, like a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games, and the good folks at element26.net. But I jotted down some terms, and I know you you have some comments too, so some of these we'll gloss over pretty quickly, but I think they're interesting to bring up. First, you know, Nick talked about this in the interview, the addition of regional terms. It's been added to it that you can, in certain regions, some terms are acceptable, but it does warn that if you use non-standard language, it's at your own risk.
Yeah, because that made me think right away, like, if somebody says, forget about it, does that mean, like, you know, if you're in Jersey, you're a fold, but in Florida, they don't know what the hell you're talking about? You know? Yeah, I don't get it.
It's a weird thing to put in, because, you know, it's like the whole, you know, swimming after no lifeguard. You know, go ahead and do it, but if you drown, hey, your problem. So, hey, go ahead and say, I pass at the World Series of Poker, but when we tell you that doesn't work, it's your problem. It's almost like a nothingness to have it in there, right?
Yeah. Yep. I know, I watched, I remember that movie Benny and June?
I remember it, but I don't think I've ever saw it.
There's a poker scene in it, and they're gambling or something. They're playing 5-card draw or something, and the guy says pass. And I thought, they're not playing jacks or better, so what does he mean by pass? Does he mean check, or does he mean fold? And maybe think of this rule. So it is kind of interesting. Why can't you just say, you have to say pass, you have to say fold? And that's the rule. You have to say fold, or you have to mucky cards. Why can't it just be the rule?
Oh, you know, when we teach our little Poker 1 classes, we say, just verbalize your action and all this other BS going on, and why you can't say this and that goes out the window.
Right. Although verbalizing it, you know, verbalizing past and still.
Well, no, but I mean, what I'm saying is just use the terms that everybody knows.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm not trying to deregionalize your game somewhere, but, you know, when you say bet, when you say raise, when you say fold, you say call, people know what you mean.
Yeah.
When you say some other variation of it, it opens you up to confusion. So just don't do it.
No, don't do it, man. Don't do it.
Just don't do it. Don't go in that room. all right, this one I thought was funny, too, because I saw this happen at a tournament in Dania a while back. A player who starts a tournament in the wrong seat but with the correct stack will move to the correct seat with his or her current stack. Now, of course, when I saw it in Dania, the guy was in the wrong seat, was knocked out before he realized he was in the wrong seat.
All right.
So I'm not going to help him, but I did always wonder. It was the first time I ever saw that happen. You know, somebody actually sat down in the wrong seat, the dealer didn't check, and started playing. What happens to him? So apparently they don't get eliminated. They just get moved to the right seat.
Oh, okay, because I'm wondering what the alternative is, why this rule's even in place. I mean, what are you going to do, give them different chip stack? I mean, so you're saying that if you sit in the wrong seat, you were thinking that maybe they could be penalized by being eliminated from the tournament?
I don't know.
That's what I mean. I don't know.
It's not in the rule, but...
I don't know what the alternative to that is, but...
But, you know, I wonder about this, too. I mean, of course, it would take some shenanigans, but we know poker players know how to do shenanigans, you know.
Yeah.
You know, what if you had two buddies and, you know, one of you is passive, one is aggressive. You look at the table and, like, hey, that's a table where passiveness needs to be, and then that's a table where aggressiveness would work. Let's just accidentally switch spots.
Yeah.
You know, no one catches us. You know, we're playing at the same time, and when they do catch us, oh, I'm sorry. Didn't realize.
Yeah.
And move you at that point. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'll be curious next time we have Nick on or some other bay from TDA to let us know what kind of examples of this happened and what the rule was before. This was a good one. This came up. Our listener Bernice Q brought this up. You know, she's at the table signing with a player.
Right.
Wanting to know if English only applied to American Sign Language. And so they got a new rule of special needs that tournament directors can make accommodations for players with special needs when possible.
So in other words, if they need, like Hal Lebarski is a good example. He can't see his cards, so
yeah, exactly.
He brings somebody with him who can see the cards. I still don't know how that would work with American Sign Language unless you had your translator there with you saying what people were doing. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Well, I think it's kind of one of these, I'm just guessing, but I like to call them protection clauses. you know, you throw it in there so, you know, it gives tournament directors a little leeway to say, you know, hey, I've got the power to try to accommodate this player as best I can, but at the same time, letting them tell the player, hey, I can't accommodate you in the way you want to be accommodated.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
I don't know. All right, another one was you got to turn your cards face up for all ends as soon as all betting action is complete. And they had a note that I thought was very interesting in here, that the dealers and players should insist on timely compliance with this rule.
So in other words, you should turn over your cards as soon as betting is over so we see what you have, and yeah, don't fool around.
Yeah, none of this waiting until it's the board's run out and playing shenanigans on who turns over first. When it's all in, the cards have to be up. And insisting on timely compliance. I like that, because that's always a problem. You're sitting at the table and people, I don't need to turn my cards over yet. I'll turn them over at the end, or I'll wait. And, you know, in a tournament, again, remember the TDA is for tournaments, not cash games.
Yeah.
It's completely different. A tournament, you got a clock going, and the longer some bozo sits at the table wasting time, the more it hurts everybody else at the tournament.
That's right.
So, all right, well, a couple more things on Showdown, too. They clarified the Showdown order. The player who made the last aggressive action in the round shows first, but if there's no bet in the last round, it goes by position from the left of the button.
Hmm.
All right, so, for example, you raise on the turn, guy calls, but on the river you both check it down. If he's out of position, he has to show first rather than you.
Right. That makes sense, because it's a whole fresh round, so there's no aggression on that last round. So now you just got to go in the order of position. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and I can see the confusion, because most people know the last aggressive action is the one that shows first.
Right.
And, you know, they're just clarifying that that's not always the case here. And another one, too, in Showdown, if everyone mucks at Showdown, the last live hand wins. And a player who mucks without revealing cannot ask to see the winning hand. All right, so you have the river, everybody doesn't think they win, so people start mucking. As long as you hold on the cards.
Right.
Until everybody else mucks, that pot's yours, baby. But more interesting there was if you muck without revealing, now all of a sudden you can't ask to see the winning hand.
Right, you've given up your right.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you want to see that hand, you got to show them yours. Seems fair.
Okay. Speaking of that, asking to see a hand, it's a TD, tournament director's privilege, unless it's a house policy. Is that...
Yeah, I like this one now, because we talked about this too. I mean, it's something that players take advantage of. You know, hey, I'm going to see that hand, and they don't understand that it's something that's reserved for ethics,
right?
You know, collusion, and so this now gives the tournament director the right to say, "Hey, to the TDA rules, you got to tell me why you want to see that hand.
Yeah.
It better not be just I'm curious."
Yeah.
And that's, of course, you know, the casino that you're playing in has a policy that allows you to do that. But I like that. I mean, what we're seeing this year is some clarifications of things that were probably a little ambiguous in the past.
It's interesting because if poker rooms say we follow TDA rules, then do they have house policies that would supersede their own TDA rules? Or, you know, I wonder.
I believe Jody's told me in the past, maybe told us in the past, that, you know, rooms are obviously allowed to adopt their own rules that are reflective of their property. I would think in general, though, you would want to conform to TDA as much as possible to avoid confusion. That's why you use the TDA.
Right.
But I think probably what we've seen, and Nick explained it too, I mean, you've got, you know, 140 people at this summit, and, you know, thousands of members around the world. They all have their own opinions on things. So you try to come to some kind of agreement that everybody can live with, but at the same time give people some freedom to run their room the way they want to. So, all right, this is another one too. I think we had a mailbag on this a while back. You know, someone calls the clock on you, and the TD comes over and starts counting down. When is the hand dead? Is it when he counts to one? When he says, so what they added is that the tournament director will now make a declaration that time has expired. At that point is when the hand is dead.
Okay, so he go 10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1, hand is dead.
Right.
So now does it become when he says the word dead, or if he goes, I mean, you could go on forever with this.
That'll be in the 2013 summit.
That's a good point, though.
All right, this is a good one, because we talked about this recently. It's not probably quite the same thing we talked about, but it's good for folks to know. Multiple chip betting. All right, and I like this one because they gave us an example, and I think you need an example to understand exactly what they're talking about. And the example they put in there is, let's say you're playing at a level 200, 400, and a player raises to 1,200, and it gets to you, and you put out two 1,000 chips without saying raise. All right, you follow me?
Yep.
That's a call, because removing one chip is less than the call. So if you take one chip out, it'd only be 1,000, and you're not actually calling. So if you think you're raising to 2,000 there, it's a call.
Yeah, because you can you raise a 2,000? Yeah, I guess you can, right? Because it would be 800, yeah.
That's 800, so yeah.
Jeez.
Once again, it gets back to what we teach at Poker One. Verbalize your action. Don't just say raise to 2,000.
But I don't understand why.
Say raise to 2,000, there's no problem.
I don't understand why this is not a raise, though. Because regardless of when they say removing one is less than a call, who cares? If you put two out there and it's a legitimate raise, then why do you have to say raise? It's a legitimate raise of two of another 800. I don't get that call. I don't agree with that rule at all, unless it's just not written correctly to them. I don't know. I don't agree with that at all. And the reason that they give is because removing one is less than... What the hell does that matter? Why would I care if I'm removing one? Two chips to me... If it is the amount of a raise, is a raise. I don't agree with that at all. Maybe there's more to it. I don't know. That doesn't make any sense at all to me.
All right, we'll follow up with Nick and Jody and see what we find out about that.
Yeah, because I don't get that at all.
You know, here's one that's real controversial with our listeners. And hey, it's in the rules now, so like it or not, accepted action. A player is on the hook even if given bad information from the dealer or from anyone else, unless the tournament director rules otherwise. So once again, a reminder that you got to know what's correct before you make your action.
Yeah.
And merely asking the dealer to give you that information is not sufficient enough. So, you know, it gets back to this whole thing. Well, you know, really? Seriously? I can't trust the dealer now? I understand that, but, you know, this is the rule. So, you know, I don't know what you do if you ask a dealer, how much is that bet? And it's 4,000 chips, you know, in a stack, and they're all not, stacked properly. I don't know. I guess you got to get over there and count them yourself.
Yeah.
But just be aware of that. So, I mean, if you say call and, the dealer said it's 200,000 and it turns out to be 400,000, you're calling 400,000.
Whew. It's true, but it just sucks.
Well, again, and it said unless, you know, the good thing about TDA is it gives these outs to the tournament director to, you know, if they get a situation that's not what they're talking about. I think what this rule, I could be wrong, I wasn't at the summit, but I imagine what this rule is for players to pay attention to the action for the most part. And I don't think it's a rule to make a player decipher what I just mentioned. You know, you have 4,000 actual chips on the table,
right,
in different denominations, and have to figure it out. That's where the TD can come over and say, hey, all right, it's just impossible for a player to understand, to be able to count that chip stack the way it is, so we're going to let them off the hook. Whereas if it's, you know, something very simple, then too bad.
Right. But,
all right, this one I thought was interesting. If you say, I bet pot in no limit, it isn't a valid bet, but a player must make a bet of a valid amount.
I don't like that at all.
So in pot limit, you can say, I bet pot, and you are betting the pot, you know, whatever's in the pot. But in no limit, there's no such thing as a pot in no limit. You know, they don't count down the pot ever. And that you can ask the dealer to spread the pot out. So if you're betting pot, you got to know what's in the pot to bet it. So
yeah, but it's clearly opens the door for angle shooting all day long when that rule. I mean, of course, it is a tournament. But really, if you know that all you have to do is bet the minimum, when you say I bet pot, and you have one player in the hand, and the player doesn't know the TDA rules, because how many people actually read the TDA rules?
Right.
And if the dealer knows the TDA rules, and the floor knows the TDA rules, and you say I bet pot, and the guy automatically just mucks when you say that, now you've done it with betting the minimum, because then before the dealer can say anything, you know, hey, you have to bet the minimum, you know, the other guy mucked and you've won the hand betting the minimum because you said I bet pot, and then the dealer says no, you have to bet a different amount, you have to say your amount or whatever, and then you can change your mind now and bet a minimum amount because you've seen the reaction of the player regardless. You know, I don't like that at all. Just me, but I don't like it.
No, I you make a valid point there.
Thank you.
All right, non-standard betting. So when it's unclear what you're betting, it's the lesser of the available bets. And the example they put in there is, if you say, I bet 5, it's 500 rather than 5,000.
Right.
You know, I've seen this happen a couple times, you know, and I always like to clarify it when I hear, you know, make it 5. And what does that mean? I mean, most times it's pretty clear. You know, if it's a 25-500 level or 25-50 level,
right,
you bet 5, it's 500, not 5,000. But if you have stacks of 10,000, it very well could be 5,000.
Right.
So, so again, it gets back to clearly stating, you know, it's better for you to say I bet 500.
Yep, yep, absolutely. Again, just verbal is binding, so say what you mean.
This is an interesting one as well, too. Folding out a turn or in turn when it's checked to you could be could subject you to a penalty now.
Yeah, that's weird. Are you telling me that I have to stick around for another round when I want to go hit the little Doyle's room and it's checked to me and I want to fold? I can't fold.
See, I'm going
to
disagree with you on this, buddy. I hate this. I really do hate this. I hate when this is what happens. It gets to the break and somebody wants to go take a wee-wee and doesn't want to wait for the proper turn to leave, so they look at their cards and they muck them. Now you are changing the hand. You're giving people information that they should not be privy to. To me, it's almost the same as turning your cards face up.
Well, I can see out of turn, but not in turn. In turn, if it's checked to me, it's my turn to act. I can choose to fold. Why can't I fold?
Yeah, all right. Well,
it's,
I mean,
it's about
I guess
the fold, not the out of turn.
The competitiveness of the game. You know, obviously, you know, not betting the nuts on the river when you're last to act, you're not being competitive. You know, obviously, a collusion part of that as well, too. Very well could be collusion part of this, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I don't think I'll ever... I think we'll have to disagree to disagree on that one. If it's my turn to act, I'm acting by folding. So you have options, you know. I know how, like, online, some rooms didn't give you that option, but some did. Yeah. If you wanted to fold out of turn, you could fold out, you know, out of turn, but fold when it's checked to you. I don't want to play anymore.
There is room for collusion in there. I'm not saying that's why the rule is. I don't know if it's there, obviously. But, you know, let's say you again, it's more pronounced. I mean, I'm giving you a comedic example here. But, you know, it's three players on the turn. Someone bets, you raise, and then somebody re-raises. You drive the player out, the two people working together, and then the one guy folds out of turn and doesn't show his cards.
Yeah, and you can see the heads-up's about an even better example. You're heads-up with your best friend, and you have the winning hand. You don't want to win it. You want him to win. It checks to you, and you know you're going to win if you show it. You muck it, and I can see that. But, again, it's just everything has to – the planets have to align, and, you know what I mean, for it to be collusion with a check fold. So, but I understand what you're saying. So, all right, well, let's move on.
All right, and the final one I thought that I noticed, and there's obviously a lot of great rules here, so folks, go to pokertda.com, and you can see the new rules. Click on the one that has the new rules in red so you can actually read all of them and see what's changed. But the last one I noticed was conditional statements, and here's what the rule says specifically. Conditional statements of future action are strongly discouraged. They may be binding and or subject to penalty. And the example they give is if-then statements, such as, if you bet, then I will raise. So you are discouraged strongly from doing that, but they could be binding.
I love how they say a conditional statement with a conditional statement. It may be binding. It may be, you may be faced with making have to make that bet, or, you know. So, yeah, so what is it? Do you, you know, I don't understand. It's a rule. Rules shouldn't be conditional. Rules should be rules. So if you say, if you bet, I'm going to raise, then if you say that's a bet, then it is a bet. I don't know. It's weird. Kind of weird to be conditional on a conditional thing to me. But whatever.
All right. Well, that's what I saw. Like I said, everybody else, please go to pokertda.com. See what you think. Obviously, remember, you can always send us your questions, concerns, for Jody Russell, our poker room manager, in our Call the Floor segment And he will answer them on the show and in the magazine. And, of course, we'll probably have Nick back at some point to talk about some of this stuff as well, too.
But absolutely. Thanks, Nick, for being on the show. Yeah, I'm glad he came on and gave us a little peek. We just couldn't stick our heads in long enough while we were there. We're too busy seeing 800 rooms in 5 days. So appreciate him being on. Another good show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We will see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.